May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Nathan Hushuk. I represent the appellant, Jennifer Gufford. Your Honors, this case is about child support, specifically the district court's abuse of discretion by failing to modify my client's request for a child support modification upward. There are two ways in which this court abused its discretion. The first and foremost being that it failed to consider the non-passive income that Mr. Gufford, or Joel, as it may be easier to differentiate, receives from his corporation. The second is that, at the very least, we have distributions being made to Joel from the corporation to pay his tax liability every year. The district court abused its discretion by failing to consider those for purposes of calculating child support as well. With regard to the non-passive income, it's non-passive because it's actively earned by Joel. He's an active member of the corporation, and he goes day in day in the field and works and earns it, which can be different from the passive income this court has dealt with in a previous case.
So was he getting tax draws, basically? Was he getting a tax draw to pay taxes in April?
The corporation calculates, or he goes to his accountant, calculates the amount that it's going to, or an average.
Estimates,
exactly. And then the corporation pays it or tells him what type of distribution amounts he's going to receive to pay it and cover it.
And then that's included in his income the following year? Or for that year, for that taxable year?
I never saw that it was actually included in the following year to then be taxed on, because that was one of my concerns, was if you're getting those payments, tax payments from a corporation or an employer to pay your taxes is then taxable income that you should be taxed the following year. I don't know if the way they were doing it in the subchapter S corporation fit into that that parameter.
What was the explanation for not having the K-1s for 2014 and 15?
Your Honor, I don't think they existed or could be found.
How is that possible?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Were they requested in a request for production?
Absolutely. They were requested as part of the tax returns, all schedules that would be attached to them.
Was there a motion to compel?
I don't think there was, Your Honor. When I looked through the record, I would admit that I was there just as the trial and as a co-counsel in the trial. And looking at back of the pleadings, I didn't see a motion to compel. Whether that's because there was a realization that or there was a lack of realization that we didn't have them, or if they were told by opposing counsel that they didn't exist. To that question, though, Your Honor, I don't think it matters on whether those exist or not.
We're missing some important information if you have to look at averaging.
You can discern that information from the tax returns themselves, and they speak for themselves.
You can look at the Schedule E's to get some general idea.
Right.
Of how much was distributed for the tax liabilities that he's talked about. But what's troubling is I don't think anywhere in the record, and I think this is what the trial court was saying, is that the burden of proof wasn't met to establish, you know, let's just take 2016 because that was the big year.
Sure.
Right? $399,000 in K-1 income, that's the pass-through income, his one half of the pass-through income of the S corporation. And so we don't know what the company then did, or if it had already allocated that money to, say, pay off investment loans, or they were buying new real estate, or we don't know what they did, and I don't know that those questions were asked.
So there's two. So the first is, prior to that, I want to understand that we don't need the Schedule E or the K-1 necessarily to discern what the distributions were. He testified that these amounts are paid every year. My tax liability is paid every year. All we need to do is go to the end of every tax return, show the tax owed, and add those four numbers up. You can get that number on the 14 and 15 without having a K-1, and the account said the K-1 isn't necessarily accurate anyway, because it's a document created by the corporation, and the endeavor doesn't actually reflect distributions. And as for the burden of proof on my client.
Where were the S corporation returns? Why weren't those offered?
They were. Those are the tax returns.
No. There were no S corporation returns. In fact, the trial judge said that S corporations don't have to file them.
No, it's an election. So it's an election. That's why it goes on the Schedule C, and it's passed through taxation. So it's not a separate tax return. It goes passed through to the shareholder, and it goes under then the Schedule E.
But the corporation itself has to file a tax return, an S corporation tax return.
happens, and I'm going to defer to the court.
Did you request those?
I'm going to defer to the court. I didn't believe that was requested. My understanding is that those aren't a product of the corporation and what they're required to do their taxes.
Did you put your request for production in and make an issue that the documents weren't produced that you requested? I mean, did you offer them?
A motion to compel, or?
Or even just your request for production and the lack of response by the opposing party?
No, the issue wasn't brought up that we lacked those K-1s because we didn't think they were needed. We could discern the amount specifically.
But your argument at trial was simply, this is the pass-through income, and so we should count that as his income, but that isn't correct. That money belongs to the corporation until it distributes that money out. And there's no evidence in the record as to how that money was distributed.
Okay, and to that point, because you requested it earlier, is that goes to the retained earnings and the child support.
We don't even know if they retained any earnings.
Mr. Guthrie did testify that those were amounts, or that $381,000 that comes after the
Depreciation.
The deduction of $18,000 or whatnot on the Schedule E. His argument was, because we obviously said this is non-passive, you actively earned it, it should be presumptively included in your child support calculation. He said, well, that was retained by the corporation, or that was the argument. Therein we fall into the court has the jurisdiction to include retained earnings if it's excessive or inappropriate.
He actually testified that that whole amount was retained?
That's my recollection, is that he didn't receive that amount, and that was the basis
for. Well, not receiving it and them retaining it are two different things. Right.
If he says he didn't receive it, he said the corporation retained it. Yes, he didn't receive a distribution. The corporation retained those funds.
But your recollection of the record is he actually said that the corporation retained those earnings, not that they spent it on other debt that they had or investments they were making.
There's actually no evidence for why they kept $381,000 with the corporation, which was only half of the amount kept in there.
Whose burden would it be to show that would be excessive?
Your Honor, it is our burden. And Coffey lays out, and I think it could be, because this is a developing area of the law, what those factors are to define what's excessive and what is inappropriate. And we went through and past earnings history, ownership share, income received by the shareholder, shareholder's ability to control the distributions, any attempts to shelter the retained earnings, and then what the retained earnings were used for. The first five that I listed there, we had evidence of that favored showing that it was excessive or inappropriate. The sixth one gets me because I don't know how my client or any more we could do to prove that they did not retain that income for a business purpose. It's very difficult for us as counsel to walk up there and basically ask someone in a corporation, prove to us that you didn't use that income for business related purposes. And so I think at the very least, the fact that there was no evidence produced by them that they used it for a business purpose after having shown that they make a substantial amount of money, he has 50% owner share, he attempted to shelter his income, he receives a very low amount of salary. After showing all those things, I think the fact that it was omitted is the evidence that we met, because there was no evidence to say he invested or capital.
He had
paid
to be
off
asked, right? I mean, so
the company profited
$800,000. That was their ordinary business income in 2016. They each had to pass through half of that. About $300,000 went to taxes. So there's $500,000 roughly in 2016 that we don't know what the company did. We can't presume. I mean, if it wasn't distributed to him, which it may not have been, then, and we wouldn't know that till we saw the K-1 for 2017, which we didn't get in this record, then we don't know if no one is asked and no one is brought in, no one subpoenaed to come in and testify as to where that $500,000 of net profit was spent, or was it being retained, and if it was being retained, why? And without knowing why, we can't know if it was excessive or not. If they were going to buy a $500,000 building, that might be reasonable and not excessive. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, Your Honor. I do. But I think that's the flaw in what we have to do. I think that's the flaw in the guidelines here and putting that entire burden on my client. Because if I ask those questions, I am setting myself up for failure as attorney. And Mr. Guthrie could tell me whatever he wanted, and I won't know the difference. He could tell me there's a building in Iowa that he's getting ready to invest in, and I don't know if that's true or not. I can't subpoena from him See, I don't know those things.
Well, if you take his deposition and get that information, then you could look into the legitimacy.
But he could send me in circles, Your Honor.
But that didn't even happen here, right?
You're right. It didn't, because we, admittedly, the case took different turns. But I don't think that was necessary. I think at the very least, when you look at those six factors, at the very least that we have here, we showed that there was a substantial amount of income there and no evidence that he put it anywhere other than his back pocket to shelter it so that he didn't have to pay more in child support because he gave himself a $15,000 raise the year before and he had to change his salary every year prior to that. And then the 1 year, if I may finish, in the 1 year that he, a request for modification child support happens, he says, nope, I'm not going to give myself a raise despite having over $500,000 in income.
I actually want to, if I may, ask another question. So there was, Mr. Guthard testified that he did get in-kind benefits. He had a company vehicle, he had insurance coverage, he had a cell phone, credit cards, fuel and tires were covered. What evidence was put on as to the value of those items?
There wasn't, Your Honor. That was offered specifically because we have an argument as well that even if these other arguments fail, there's equity involved. And equity in that Gingrich case, and Gingrich was that sometimes you pierce the corporate structure, and the fact that, and we thought the fact that he was getting all of these benefits from the corporation in addition to sheltering income, in addition to getting a tax distribution, goes to the equity and therefore breaking the corporate system. So we admit there was no values for those specifically, and no evidence was against for that.
Because at a minimum, the district court, if it would have had those values, could have added that to his income.
Sure, yes.
Did the district court indicate why it didn't add the tax distribution money?
Well, it did say, with Judge Bishop's argument, was that we don't have the K-1 for 2014 and 2015, and therefore we can't discern. And I would respectfully disagree with that, because all you got to do is look at the tax owed at the end of each. You calculate up, and his testimony was they pay that amount every year. That's your number at a minimum for 2014-2015. He may have received more, and I'm fine with not knowing that, and my client's fine with not knowing that, because we'll at least know the minimum. And so those numbers were plausible. I had asked that I wanted those to be averaged out to get a number that he could see every year at the very least that would be consistent with this court's case in Coffee. So we're going to ask that you do that and enter those instructions accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time did we take appellant over?
2 minutes.
Would you please add that to the appellee's time?
Hopefully I don't take that much time.
It's
voluntary. Good afternoon, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Crisp. I'll remember to introduce myself this time. I'm an attorney at Jacobson Orr in Kearney, and I have the pleasure of representing Mr. Joel. It's actually Goodhart. It's spelled Guthard, but Goodhart. So I understand that the court maybe misreading that literally. The relief that we're seeking as appellee on appeal is an affirmance of the district court's order, which found that there was no material change of circumstances that would warrant any modification of appellee's child support obligation. I think the court has astutely noted a number of issues that I'd just like to go through and highlight, starting with the most recent with Chief Judge Moore. You stated, why did the district court not include that 2016 distribution? The Noonan versus Noonan standard, when including all sources of income for child support, the initial burden that the appellant has to hurdle is whether or not income is earned or reasonably expected to be earned in a certain amount on a regular basis. That distribution, there was specific testimony by appellee that 2016 was an unusual profitable year. The court astutely noted that the tax return played that out as well. And then that I see that as a similar or akin to a one-time bonus that maybe is not reasonably expected to incur in the future. So the district court, using the slim evidence that it had here, said, okay, well, if there was a distribution in 2016, I could see if there was a distribution in 15 and in 14 that I could do some kind of income fluctuations depending on what those numbers were. If they were a varying fluctuation, we'd average. If they were a trending trajectory, we could take the highest. But because there's a missing distribution in 14, missing distribution in 15, then how are we to know whether or not that 16 distribution is reasonably expected to occur in the future? I'm sorry?
Why were they missing?
Great question, Your Honor. And I think the last
one. But your clients. They're in your client's control.
You're correct, Your Honor, except for when it came to trial, it was not our burden to prove there was a material change in circumstances. When I took this case over as appellate counsel, that's exactly where I went. Where's the motion to compel discovery? Where's there's any kind of request for discovery request that my client was even asked? We don't even know if there's any, how this came. Was this a subpoena directly from the CPA? Was this through discovery through my client? Certainly at trial when, if you read the record, there's about 40 pages of the CPA that testified. Mr. Schroeder, trial counsel, was going through trying to get some background information about the corporation that was objected to by Ms. Frank at trial for speculation and foundation grounds. So I think if I was trial counsel in that moment, I'd say, well, this is the only expert witness other than my client, which I have control over, that you're going to get this particular evidence in. And so I'm not going to prove your case for you.
Was this accountant the accountant for both your client and the corporation, or was it just the corporation?
I will tell you that the record is not clear on that. So. I can't attest to that. I will tell you that the basis of the sustaining objections that Ms. Frank made were that Mr. Kostler, the CPA, didn't know exactly what Mr. Goodhart would earn, only that he knew what the tax returns stated for the corporation. So from that, I think the court could infer that he was solely the corporation's accountant, but there was no specific question to answer that in the record.
I want to go back to the tax distribution, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, but my understanding of Mr. Husak's argument is that for the 4 years in question, that you simply need to look at his tax return, what taxes he owed, mm-hmm. and presume that the corporation's distributions equaled mm-hmm. that. So you don't need the missing K-1s.
I take grave issue with that argument for multiple reasons, and I'll assign your clerk an assignment, which I'm sure he'll love for me to do later. In the appellant's brief, the initial brief and the reply brief, they state that what the tax liability would have been in 2015 and 2014. Remember, those are the years where we're missing the K-1, mm-hmm. and they're arguing it would at least be this amount. The citation they make is just the exhibit and spans 20 plus some pages. I can't determine, and I looked at the exhibit every page. I can't justify the numbers that they came up with that would say his tax liability was at least this amount. If the clerks can prove me otherwise, I couldn't find anything to justify those numbers.
Well, here's what I found kind of interesting and disconcerting, that the 2 years were missing, because in 2012, he was distributed $46,663. His tax liability for the corporate income was only $2,627. So he actually personally gained $44,000 that year. The next year, in 2013, he was distributed $61,375. His tax liability would have only been $22,000. So he personally, on top of the tax liability, pocketed $38,901. It was definitely going in an upward trajectory. And then he doesn't provide 2014 and 15, years in which the corporate income was still high. It was $93,000 in 2014. It was $189,000 his half in 2015. So it is troubling that there's not evidence in the record that the requests were made mm-hmm. and just not responded to completely. But there are some ways to construe, you know, the amounts of money that were passing through based mm-hmm. on the tax returns that were provided, because we can see the company was definitely going in an upward direction mm-hmm. Over those years.
I don't know if there's a question in there, but I'll continue with that trail
yeah,
of thought, Your
sorry.
Honor. That's fine.
yeah.
That's fine. So
I guess it goes back to, you know, why would those documents mm-hmm. not be available, and why are there no S corporation documents? You don't know because you
yeah.
weren't trial counsel. You don't know because
I enjoy
yeah.
not being trial counsel, because yeah. I'm viewing the same record that the court is viewing. I see that as a benefit. So to address the numbers and the projection that you were just talking about, Your Honor, I think that the without specifically knowing what numbers you're referencing, he had state liability, both in Iowa, Kansas,
yeah.
and Nebraska, and federal.
And I was looking
federal.
At that.
Okay, great.
I was looking at that.
The most recent 2016, the CPA, Kostler, specifically testified that he was given a distribution of 137 and paid taxes of 133. So he only had 4,400 left over.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot in 2016. Mm-hmm. What evidence is there in the record as to what happened to the other, you know, 500,000? So his share, $250,000. What happened?
There was, and I question this standing here, there was absolutely no questions asked of Mr. Goodhart. Where is your schedule or your K-1 for 2015? Where is your K-1 for 2014? I don't know if this is simply a reproducing of the CPA's records and it just wasn't included in that packet. Certainly there's no evidence of bad will or ill motive or manipulation introduced
at all. But I mean, for 2016, we know that there was his share of the profit or what he had to pay income on was about almost $400,000. We know 150 of that or 137 went to taxes. So roughly $250,000.
Yes, I see your question
yeah.
now, Your Honor.
Where did that go?
So on the non-passive income K-1, the retained earnings that's up there does not account, up in the left-hand corner, that I'm visualizing that K-1, does not account for non-deductible expenses, as Judge Bishop, you noted, buying a building, you know, capital for a loan. An example, our firm, wining and dining customers. Those are expenses that our firm pays that at the end of the year it looks like we still have sitting in our account, but
well,
it's
not
there.
Well, that would already have been accounted for because by the time you get to the ordinary business income that's identified on the K-1, all of those deductions have been taken out. This is the profit. What you see on the K-1 is essentially the company's profit.
I'd respectfully disagree that the deductions that show up on the K-1 are the Section 179, the deductible expenses, not the non-deductible expenses, which in an S corporation like GAS Electrical Services could be very large. That buying the building, equipment that's depreciated, that would be accounted for. But other non-deductible expenses. The point that I'm getting to is that non-passive income, there's no proof that that non-passive income amount is sitting in a bank account
yeah.
somewhere.
We don't know that it was retained. It may
exactly.
have been spent on
exactly.
legitimate business expenses. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no evidence in the record as to how that $250,000 was used.
I agree. And until that... until appellant proves and meets its hurdle of that the non-passive income is excessive or inappropriate, would there be any looking at my client as to what that income is used for?
But the other, you know, the other issue is just to kind of go back to the argument made with regard to just this being an equity situation, right? And if they have at least met their burden, that we can reasonably expect a certain amount of increased earnings on a regular basis, and looking at all of the different tax returns and the information we do have, he was definitely going in an upward direction in terms of his company. Is it fair and equitable for the company to not allocate a higher salary to him in light of the increased earnings of that company?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. Two things. I don't think that equity can grasp at thin air, which that's what our record has here. There's gaping holes.
There are holes, mm-hmm. but there is a lot of information also.
Yeah, and I also believe that there's the equitable principle that we can look past the corporate structure and see exactly what is being done with that money. I think that the converse is here true that it would benefit my client is we can look at to what's being used with the money and that he actually doesn't realize any of those funds.
But isn't it enough that they met the burden of establishing with the documents they did submit that he was on this upward direction in terms of his company making more and more money, we can see that in this record, then the burden then shifted to your client to show that there could not be a reasonable expectation or that it would be speculative for the court to conclude that he was going to get more income distributed to him. Didn't the burden shift and did he meet that burden?
No, I think that the guidelines as section 4204 makes the rule for us. It says that income may be considered from retained earnings of a closely held corporation may be considered if it's proven excessive or inappropriate. The converse, the rule is not that the court can consider those retained incomes earnings unless the earnings do not appear to be excessive or inappropriate. So it's on the appellant to prove that it's excessive and inappropriate, which they have not done. Even with notwithstanding the tax returns in the record, I don't think there's anything, you know, circling back in hindsight, I think just one factual expert that would have said, okay, I've reviewed, if I may continue, like a document review in a personal injury case. I've reviewed all the tax returns in this case. And in my experience as a CPA or doing books for similar S corporations, it would be, in my expert opinion, an excessive or inappropriate for this upward trajectory to retain those earnings. But with an unusually profitable year, the nature of this business relying on ethanol plants, I don't think there's anything to show other than this could just be a prudent business decision.
So we have to expect people to come up with the money to pay a CPA $3,000 or $5,000 to be able to make a case when the evidence is otherwise fairly clear that someone's making a lot more money than he's having to contribute to his child support.
May I answer your question?
Please.
I believe that in that circumstance, if you have vindictive parents, which I'm sure the court gets its chance of seeing, is that's where attorney fees would come in involved in that a district court. If there was an expert that came up and said, yes, he or she is sheltering income, or we have all of these issues, that it would be party's obligation to ask the court for not only attorney's fees but expert fees. But I don't think that places any burden on my client, who is just working his job, earning income for his family, growing a business possibly just prudently, and then all of a sudden having to spend expert fees to prove that it's not excessive, not inappropriate on every single complaint to modify child support at Ms. Goodhart's
when it's her burden. Had she filed any other ones before this one? My recollection is that there was quite a bit of a gap between the original order.
There had been, Your Honor. I believe this, it's outside the record. I believe the parties have more turmoil than is adequately reflected
in
by the pleadings. So with that, Your Honors, I'd submit and ask for an affirmance of the order.
And see, now you didn't think you were going to use all the time, and we took you over.
Mr. Husak,
if you would like
Bishop
a minute
all
for,
afternoon, so.
If you would like a minute for rebuttal, I would certainly offer it to you. You're not obligated. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your attendance here today. You are excused.